Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam 6th Canto, Chapter 16, Text 26. Shri Sukha Uvacha. Bhaktayaitam Prapanaya. Vijam Adishanarada. Yayab Angirasa Sakyam. Dhamma Swayam Bhuvam Prabho. Shri Sukhuvacha. Bhaktayaitam Prapanaya. Vijam Adishanarada. Yayab Angirasa Sakam. Dhamma Swayam Bhuvam Prabho. Shri Sukhuvacha. Bhaktayaitam Prapanaya. Vidyam Adishanarada. Yaya Vangirasa Sakam. Dhamma Swayam Bhuvam Prabho.
Shri Sukha Vacha.
Shri Sukhuvacha. Shri Sukadev Goswami said, Bhaktaya, unto the devotee, Etam, this, Prapanaya, unto one who fully surrendered, Vidyam, transcendental knowledge, Adisha, instructing, Narada, the great sage Narada. Yayo, left. Angirasa, the great saint Angira. Sakam, with. Dhamma, for the topmost planet. Swayambhuvam, belonging to Lord Brahma. Prabho, O King. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, Narada, having become the spiritual master of Chitraketu, instructed him fully in this prayer because Chitraketu was fully surrendered. O King Parikit, Narada then left with the great sage Angira for the topmost planet known as Brahma Loka. When Angira had first come to visit King Chitraketu, he did not bring Narada with him. However, after the death of Chitraketu's son, Angira brought Narada to instruct King Chitraketu about bhakti yoga. The difference was that in the beginning, Chitraketu was not in a temperament of renunciation. But after the death of his son, when he was overwhelmed by his great plight, he was awakened to the platform of renunciation by instructions regarding the falsity of this material world and material possessions. It is only at this stage that bhakti yoga can be instructed. As long as one is attached to material enjoyment, bhakti yoga cannot be understood. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Anybody without a book want to take a guess what verse Prabhupada's referring to here? In this stage, bhakti yoga can be instructed. As long as one is attached to material enjoyment, bhakti yoga cannot be understood. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, correct. Did you read the purport before? Oh. All right, anyway. Yeah. Well, you want to give the translation? Go ahead. Yeah, the resolute determination for devotional service to the Supreme Lord does not take place. So it goes on, Prabhupada says, as long as one is very much attached to material enjoyment, one cannot concentrate his mind on the subject matter of devotional service. The Krishna consciousness movement is progressing successfully in the Western countries at the present moment because the youth in the West have reached the stage of vairagya, or renunciation. They are practically disgusted with material pleasure from material sources. And this has resulted in a population of hippies throughout the Western countries. Now, if these young people are instructed about bhakti yoga, Krishna consciousness, the instructions will certainly be effective. As soon as Chitraketu understood the philosophy of vairagya vidya, the knowledge of renunciation, he could understand the process of bhakti yoga. In this regard, Srila Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya has said, yeah, but let's start at the beginning of the verse. Last line? Anybody? Kripam? Okay. Translation, anybody? Okay, I'll read it. Let me take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who has descended in the form of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to teach us real knowledge, his devotional service, and detachment from whatever does not foster Krishna consciousness. He has descended because he is an ocean of transcendental mercy. Let me surrender unto his lotus feet. That's Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. And that verse appears in the Chaitanya Chandrodaya Natika. Okay, so, yeah, Vairagya Vidya and Bhakti Yoga are parallel lines. One is essential for understanding the other. It is also said, bhakti pareshanu bhavo virakti anyatra cha. That's from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, chapter 2, text 42. Advancement in devotional service or Krishna consciousness is characterized by increasing renunciation of material enjoyment. Narada Muni is the father of devotional service, and therefore, just to bestow causeless mercy upon King Chitraketu, Angira brought Narada Muni to instruct the king. These instructions were extremely effective. Anyone who follows in the footsteps of Narada Muni is certainly a pure devotee. Om Aginatam Anandasya Janam Jana Shalakaya Chakshuram Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurudevena Maha Shri Chaitanya Manobhastam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So the first thing that struck me when I was reading this translation and purport was a question arose in my mind. Why is Angira Muni calling in Narada Muni to do the preaching? Because I thought to myself, wait, Angira Muni, he's a pretty big name. He's one of the, I couldn't remember exactly what his, history was, but that name just stuck in my mind as like, wow, he's a pretty big name sage, Rishi or Muni. And it says right here in the word for word translation, which I didn't catch until just now, it says Angira, the great saint. So he's referred to as a great saint. It wasn't just like he was just some run-of-the-mill sadhu that happened to be there. He was a great saint. Then I went on the Veda base, and I just, researched his name, and I found that, it was just what I thought. He's like a very, pretty big personality. Angira Muni is, his greatest qualification is that he was one of the six mentally generated sons of Lord Brahma. At the beginning of creation, Lord Brahma had some mentally generated sons. Angira is one of them. And he's considered the leader of the followers of the Atharva Veda. At the end of Lord Brahma's day, at the beginning of the new day, he is created from the transcendental body of the Lord. Because he's not even like, didn't give any description, but he's some special personality. He's created from the transcendental body of the Lord. He's the father of Brihaspati, who's the spiritual master of the demigods. Samika Muni, the sage that Maharaj Prickett put the garland of the snake around, is in his family. He's still alive today at Alokananda. He's on the banks of the Ganges at a place called Alokananda, still performing devotional service to this very day. He's considered one of the nine principal rishis. And he was married. He married the daughter of Kardama Muni, one of the nine daughters of Kardama Muni, named Shraddha. So with all these qualifications, I was just thinking to myself, wow, what's going on here? Why is that? Why did he, call in Narada Muni? Why didn't he just instruct him? It sounds like he would be more than qualified to have just instructed him himself. So anybody want to say? Why did he call in Narada Muni? Why didn't he just instruct him himself? Satchidanoy? It's a good question, isn't it? Is it a logical question? Logical. Okay, good. Yeah. 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 That's what I came up with too. I think that's the correct answer. And I tried to, and I found a reference for that in a purport by Srila Prabhupada. Here it is. It's from the third canto, chapter 32, text 42. In the purport, Prabhupada says, "The disciple should not be unnecessarily envious of his godbrothers. Rather, if a godbrother is more enlightened and advanced in Krishna consciousness, one should accept him as almost equal to the spiritual master, and one should be happy to see such godbrothers advance in Krishna consciousness." So I guess that was Angira Muni's realization, or that was his attitude, that he thought, well, I also know this information. I'm also capable of giving him some. But I think he'll even get more benefit if he hears it from Narada Muni, who's, such a great, great, great devotee. And, so he thought, okay, he'll do that. So it was Vaishnava etiquette, partly Vaishnava etiquette, and partly, but more probably that he just appreciated the exalted position of Narada Muni. And as far as the Vaishnava etiquette part of it goes, is that example earlier in the Bhagavatam where Vidura is wanting to hear about Krishna consciousness, and he's associating with Uddhava, but Uddhava sends him to Maitreya. Actually, Uddhava is more advanced in terms of the knowledge of devotional service than Maitreya, but Maitreya was senior. And he was also, a greatly elevated saint. So etiquette, Uddhava observed that etiquette, and he sent him to hear from Maitreya. Okay, so Angira Muni is sending him to Narada Muni. And here in the purport, Prabhupada refers to, it's a good call, you know, because here in the purport, Prabhupada refers to Narada Muni as the father. What does he say? Narada Muni is the father of devotional service, and therefore, just to bestow causeless mercy upon King Chitraketu, Angira brought Narada to instruct the king. So then I was reflecting upon, yeah, Narada Muni, wow. Actually, when you stop and think about it, Narada Muni is really like, you know, in a very exalted position. I mean, just to go over a few of his glories, Narada Muni is the, well, for starters, he's the spiritual master of Vyasadeva. You know, Vyasadeva is considered a literary incarnation of Krishna. Narada Muni is his spiritual master. Aside from that, Narada Muni is the spiritual master of Prahlad Maharaj. He's the spiritual master of Dhruva Maharaj. He's considered the chief sage among the demigods. Prabhupada, in one purport, refers to him as a perfect man comparable with himself only. That's how Prabhupada refers to him, at least in one purport. He instructed many kings. Among them were King Puchini Barisat, King Barisat, in the fourth canto. We just recently went over that. And he actually even instructed Prahlad Maharaj when he was in the womb of his mother, as he was such a potent, you know, preacher that he was confident that he wasn't, you know, wasting his time. He knew that Prahlad Maharaj was, you know, a great devotee. So he was instructing Prahlad Maharaj even while he was in the womb of his mother. And of course his mother forgot everything, but Prahlad Maharaj remembered everything, and he, you know, he benefited by those instructions. He instructed Krishna's father, Vasudev. He instructed Maharaj Yudhisthira. These are all in the Bhagavatam. He instructed the sons of Daksha, which were the, what are the names? The Savalasvas and the Haryashvas. He instructed both of them. He even instructed Kamsa at one point in the Bhagavatam. Can anybody think of any more things, you know, appearances of Narada Muni in the Bhagavatam? Imagrari, yeah. Right. Yeah, so he's a very great exalted personality. So that was, you know, helped me better understand why it is that Angira was deferring to Narada Muni. Also on this point, just backing up a teeny little bit, on this point of, you know, where Prabhupada says here, one should accept the advanced godbrothers almost equal to the spiritual master, and one should be happy to see such godbrothers advance to Krishna consciousness. So, you know, this is touching upon this point of Vaishnava etiquette, which is a, you know, big, broad subject. But one other thing that just came to my mind immediately when I heard this, because it actually came up in yesterday's purport, is that, okay, of course we should have that attitude towards more advanced godbrothers, you know, seeing them as almost equal with the spiritual master. But, you know, it's a good idea to have a very respectful attitude towards all the devotees, and which, you know, is obvious, goes without saying. But I just remembered, I think it was the last sentence in yesterday's purport, where Prabhupada says, the devotees may sometimes not be competent to serve the lotus feet of the Lord, and therefore the Lord is addressed as Parama Padameshtin. He is the supreme person, yet he is very kind to the devotees. No one is competent to serve the Lord, but even if a devotee is not competent, the merciful Lord accepts the humble attempt of the devotee. So, you know, it's stating here that Krishna, the supreme personality of Godhead, is accepting the humble attempt of the devotee. So our attitude should be that, hey, if these people are good enough for Krishna, they're good enough for me. Right? And that's how we should be thinking. Each one of us should be walking around thinking, hey, these devotees are good enough for Krishna. Krishna says right here, you know, one might not be competent, but the merciful Lord accepts the humble attempt of the devotee. So if these, you know, they're good enough for Krishna, they're good enough for me. Right? So that's, you know, if we can remember that, right, then that'll help us, you know, help us go a long way in our dealings with other devotees. So that was another important point that came to my mind. And there was another interesting thing that came up here in the purport, in this, I guess it's the second paragraph. Prabhupada talks about the Krishna consciousness movement is progressing successfully in the Western countries at the present moment because the youth in the West have reached the stage of vairagya or renunciation. They are practically disgusted with material pleasures from material sources. Well, that's true. A lot of us were disgusted with material pleasures from material sources. And this resulted in a population of hippies throughout the Western countries. Now, these young people instructed in bhakti yoga, Krishna consciousness instructions will certainly be effective. So, This is kind of an interesting point. Prabhupada's saying how the Westerners, the present moment, the youth, have reached the stage of vairagya. But I just wanted to point out that this vairagya that was reached by the youths in the Western countries is not exactly the same. And this is like, you know, Prabhupada's, of course, he's saying it's correct, but I'll make the point, and we could maybe even, people can throw in different point angles of vision on it. Sukadev Goswami was renounced. Bilvamangala Thakur was renounced. The four Kumaras were renounced. They'd reached the stage of renunciation. And then when they came in contact with a pure devotee, or in the case of the four Kumaras, they came in contact with Lord Vishnu himself or Lord Narayan, and they got the fragrance of the Tulsi leaves. In the case of Sukadev Goswami, he came in contact with his father, Vyasadev, narrated the Bhagavatam to him. And in the case of Bilvamangala Thakur, I can't remember exactly how but he was also a monist, and a realized monist. And I can't remember how he came in contact with devotional service, but they became attracted to devotional service. Sometimes Prabhupada gives this example, or at least I heard it once, that, Krishna consciousness is like the spark. So if a spark drops on very dry ground, like a place that's practically a desert, and it's just dry straw and dry, wood, and it has a chance of igniting because it's dry, and it's perfectly dry fuel. If the spark falls on just like some grass, might ignite, might not, or a flame. But if a flame drops on like a swamp or something like that, most likely it's just going to be extinguished because, it's just so wet and everything like that. So the point is that, the dry grass, that's like the mode of goodness. And the ordinary situation is like the mode of passion. And the swamp is like the mode of ignorance. So when Krishna consciousness is introduced to the mode of goodness, boom. It can flourish. It can blossom like anything. And the examples are there of Sukadev Goswami, Bilvamangala Thakur, and the four Kumaras. They were ripe. They were like even beyond the mode of goodness. They were, in pure goodness. And so Krishna consciousness was introduced to them. They took to it. But the qualification, with inverted commas, of the the Western youths was really they're in the mode of ignorance. Because the proof of that, Prabhupada goes on, and later in the purport says, and this has resulted in a population of hippies throughout the Western countries. So hippies aren't sages. Hippies are dropouts from the mode of goodness and even from the mode of passion. You see, so really, it's kind of like almost a euphemism. The Prabhupada's giving us, he's complimenting us on our renunciation, but our renunciation was nothing other than a dropping out of the modes of goodness and even passion and being in the mode of ignorance. But Prabhupada turned that really disqualification when you look at it from, look at the bigger picture of how the Krishna consciousness develops in the living entity, gradually elevating through the modes of nature is more of a disqualification than a qualification. But by Prabhupada's mercy, by the association of the pure devotee, he turned that disqualification into a qualification and somehow or another managed to engage the sentiments of Western youths and, get people interested in Krishna consciousness. And so a lot of us became devotees on the strength of that we were just disenfranchised. We just, due to being in the mode of ignorance, we weren't so interested in the contemporary situation in human civilization, which was dominant in the mode of passion, and Prabhupada was able to attract some of us to something else. Not everybody's in that category. Some of you, Prabhupada said also that my spiritual master sent you to assist me, referring to some of his disciples. So some of my God brothers would be in that category, that they were actually devotees in their past lives, and they were sent by Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj to assist Prabhupada in his mission of spreading Krishna consciousness throughout the Western world. Prabhupada also said that. But anyway, that's also a point there. And Prabhupada makes this point here, just so you don't think it's a total speculation. I'll read a little teeny excerpt from a purport where Prabhupada kind of really talks about that. This is from the section about Dhruva Maharaj. It says, in America, we have practical experience of this incompatibility of Brahminical and Kshatriya temperaments. The American boys who have simply been trained as Sudras are not at all fit to fight in battle. Therefore, when they are called to join the military, they refuse because they do not have the Kshatriya spirit. This is a cause of great dissatisfaction in society. And here it comes. It says, That the boys do not have the treacherous spirit does not mean that they are trained in brahminical qualities. See, in other words, that we weren't like vicious and treacherous. We weren't interested in this, you know, pursuing material enjoyment in the way our, you know, parents were and our peers were. That doesn't mean we were brahminically qualified. Prabhupada goes on to say, they are trained as sudras, and thus in frustration they are becoming hippies. So in frustration we became hippies, but Prabhupada, by the mercy, by the causeless mercy of the pure devotee and the parampara disciplic succession, we got an opportunity to come to Krishna consciousness and develop brahminical qualifications. So, you know, that's, and say Thanksgiving. So, tying that in, you know, Thanksgiving is a day you're supposed to give thanks. Originally, I looked it up on the internet. It's a harvest festival, is how it started off. It actually came over from Europe. It was brought over by the early settlers, and it was happening in Canada even before it was happening here in the United States. But basically, it's just something that's been going on in human society for who knows how many thousands of years. You know, it's a harvest festival means that if the harvest was good, they'd have a big festival celebrating that, hey, we had a good harvest, because people were working hard, you know, all throughout the spring and the summer, planting and doing all the different things they needed to do to produce a crop. And then right around this time of year, or a little bit earlier, they would harvest everything, and that was kind of like, okay, whew, done, we did it. Wow, that was good. Give me five, you know? And it was kind of like, you know, everybody got together and just celebrated. Oh, we had a good harvest. And give thanks to God, because they were a little bit pious, you know? They would realize that it just wasn't just our hard work. We got cooperation from, you know, powers beyond us, you know? And so they would do that. So on this occasion, we can give thanks to, take this as an opportunity to give thanks to Prabhupada for introducing us to Krishna consciousness, and, you know, which is far better than just bringing in a harvest. I mean, this is, you know, Brahmananda Brahmate Kona Bhagyavan Jeev, Guru Krishna Prashade by Bhakti Lata Beej. After wandering throughout the universe, that living entity, Kona Bhagyavan Jeev, who is greatly fortunate, Guru Krishna Prashade by Bhakti Lata Beej, comes in contact with a bona fide spiritual master and gets the opportunity to take to Krishna consciousness. So, I mean, wow. I mean, like, you know, we actually, the people, have the most to be thankful for. I mean, they let them, it's okay, do your Thanksgiving out there, that's nice. But we're the ones who really have something to be thankful for. I mean, actually, they're being thankful to, you know, God, whoever they're being thankful to, you know, give them a nice harvest, and then they sit down and kill a turkey and eat it, but and then just get implicated in more entangled in karma. But, you know, we've been given, divya gyan, transcendental knowledge which we can get out of the cycle of birth and death and go back to Godhead. So anyway, we're the real people who have the most to be thankful for. And actually, you know, Krishna consciousness is so wonderful. These books are just full of, like, information about how, you know, happiness in life, and how we can just be so happy in life. Like, I mean, here, I'll just give an example. His Nectar Devotion. I'll just open this to, you know, basically anywhere. I'll just open it to any page here, and let's just take a page at random. Well, not exactly at random, but I'm cheating a little bit here. And we'll, you know, take a page at random. Pick a page, any page, and we'll just see how it's just like, you know, it's just full of happiness. Like, here, listen to this. It says here, due to Krishna's departure from Vrindavan to Mathura, Krishna's dearest cowherd boys felt as mentally light as possible. They were like fragments of cotton, lighter than the air, and were all floating in the air without any shelter. End quote. Prabhupada speaks now. In other words, the minds of the cowherd boys became almost vacant on account of Krishna's separation, and they are compared with fragments of cotton floating in the air without any shelter. An example of, and then this is another example, was shown by the cowherd boys when Krishna went to Mathura. Out of sorrow of separation, all these boys forgot to take care of their cowherding and tried to forget all the melodious songs they used to sing. And in the pasturing ground. And at last they had no desire to live anymore, being separated from Krishna. And it goes on here to say, a friend of Krishna, who informed him in Mathura that all the cowherd boys had become just like leafless trees on the tops of hills. They appeared almost naked. Oh, maybe I'm in the wrong part here. Well, anyway, let's read on. They appeared almost naked, skinny and frail, and did not carry any fruits or flowers. He informed Krishna that all the cowherd boys residing in Vrindavan were as still as trees at the tops of hills. Sometimes they felt diseased from their separation from Krishna, and being so greatly disappointed, they were aimlessly wandering on the banks of the Jamuna. Wait a second. Better go to another part here. Let's try another page. Hang on. We'll go up a little further here. Here, I got something nice. We'll read something nice about Nanda and Yasoda here. That'll cheer us up. It says here, this is a friend of Krishna speaking. He said, "My dear lotus-eyed one, when you were living in Gokula, you were always bearing a stick in your hand. That stick is now lying idle in the house of Mother Yasoda. And whenever she sees it, she becomes motionless, just like the stick." End quote. Prabhupada speaks. This is the sign of becoming stunned in separation from Krishna. In separation from Krishna, Mother Yasoda became so humble that she prayed to the creator of the universe, Lord Brahma, with tears in her eyes. "My dear creator, won't you kindly bring my son Krishna back to me so that I can see him at least for a moment?" Sometimes in restlessness like a madwoman, Mother Yasoda used to accuse Nanda Maharaj, "What are you doing in the palace, you shameless man? Why do people call you the king of Braj? It is very astonishing that while being separated from your dear son Krishna, you are still living with him in Vrindavan as a hard-hearted father." Then it goes, "Someone informed Krishna about the madness of Mother Yasoda in the following words. In madness, Mother Yasoda has addressed the Kadamba trees and inquired from them, 'Where is my son?' Similarly, she has addressed the birds and drones and inquired from them as to whether Krishna has passed before them. And she has inquired if they can say something about you. In this way, Mother Yasoda, in illusion, was asking everybody about you, and she has been wandering all over Vrindavan." Well, maybe Nanda Maharaj does a little bit better here. Let's hear something about Nanda Maharaj, okay? Maybe he's doing a little... Says, "When Nanda Maharaj was accused by Mother Yasoda of being hard-hearted, he replied, 'My dear Yasoda, why are you becoming so agitated? Kindly look more carefully. Just see. Your son Krishna is standing before you. Don't become a madwoman like this. Please keep my home peaceful.'" End quote. Says, Krishna was informed by some friend that his father Nanda was also in illusion in this way. So he was in total denial. But anyway, wait a second. This is just a bit of bad luck here. I'll get to one more section here. Let's read something about Radharani and the gopis. That'll be much better. Okay, so here it says about Radharani. It says, "Since the auspicious day when Krishna..." This is who's speaking here. This is... it doesn't say who's speaking, but it says, "Since the auspicious day when Krishna left for Mathura, Srimati Radharani has been pressing her head on one of her hands and constantly shedding tears. Her face is always wet now, and therefore there is no chance of her sleeping even for a moment." End quote. When the face becomes wet, the sleeping tendency is immediately removed. So when Radharani was always weeping for Krishna because of his separation, there was no chance of her getting any sleep for herself. She was just crying. She couldn't even sleep. Okay? In the Prahlad Samhita, Uddhava says, "The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda, pain-stricken due to being pierced by the arrows of Cupid, is always thinking of you," referring to the gopis, "and he is not even accepting his regular lunch, nor is he getting any proper rest." So Krishna is also upset by the whole thing, too. Anyway, so the reason I read this is, so how do we understand this? You know, and one sort of interesting analogy came to my mind. Once it kind of ties in with Thanksgiving as well. Today, they have a preparation, at least they used to, in years past. They used to make a preparation called mock turkey. And they even have a name for it now in the commercial market. It's called tofurkey, something like that. Tofurkey, okay. So what it is, it's actually tofu, you know. But these chefs, the expert cooks, they're actually able to make it so that it looks like turkey, right? They can even get the texture so that it's like turkey. They can get it to, they can simulate the taste to a certain degree of turkey, and you know, probably by putting different seasonings on it, you might even be able to get it to smell like the turkey. I don't know, you know. So, you know, for somebody who didn't know anything, you know, somebody who was just coming in off the street, an uneducated observer, so to speak, or an uneducated participant could come in, could start eating that, and could really think that, wow, I'm eating turkey, you know. But Okay, are they eating turkey? I mean, are they, you know, what's the result of them eating that? If they eat, say they come to Govinda's restaurant and they eat Ratna Bhushan's mock turkey, what's the result of that? You know, is it the same as the result as if they were, you know, down at their mom and dad's house eating a turkey? No, of course not. There's like a, you know, a vast gulf of difference. By eating that the real turkey outside, they're, you know, getting all sorts of reaction to sinful activity, et cetera, et cetera. By eating the mock turkey here, which is prashadam, they're getting purified. You know, they're progressing towards going back to Godhead. So the idea is this: this stuff might appear like turkey, but there's a, you know, it's not. It's actually prashadam. It's completely transcendental. See, so appearances are deceiving. So in the same way, these activities here, when we hear about these things, they might, it seems like, might appear like, oh, wait a second, what's happiness about this? You know, you're hearing about how, you know, Mother Yasoda's like the stick, and Radharani's crying so much she can't even sleep, and the cowherd boys are, you know, trying to forget all the songs they sung to Krishna. They're lying down in the pasturing grounds. So I missed that one. And the forest animals are feeling so sorry for them because it's so pathetic. They're just lying there. They're just barely breathing. That even the deer are coming and crying. So, you know, what's going on? It sounds like unhappiness, but it's all just like in this example I gave. It's actually, it's a different energy. You know, everything, all the activities of devotional service are under the, the auspices of Yogamaya. Daivim Prakritim Ashrita. They're under the control of the internal energy of the Lord. It's just like, you know, the basic ingredient is spiritual, just like the basic ingredient of that mock turkey is tofu. It's not meat. It's tofu. And not only that, it's offered to Krishna. See? So it might seem like, oh, we're eating turkey. It looks like turkey. Texture's like turkey. Tastes like turkey even. It's not. It's prashadam. You see? So in the same way, these activities might appear like, you know, from the mundane way of thinking, it might appear like, oh, these are sufferings, but it's actually, no, it's pure, you know, transcendental spiritual activity. It's under the under the influence of Yogamaya. And one other example came to my mind on that point. So, but you might say, somebody might say, yeah, okay, but, okay, that's nice, it's transcendental, but, you know, they seem to, what are they doing? I mean, you know, how are these elevated devotees like, you know, the cowherd boys and the devotees who are in the Shakya Ras, the Vatsalya Ras, and the Madhurya Ras in Vrindavan. How are they actually serving Krishna? I mean, what are they like? They're just moping around. I mean, like when Prabhupada and the six Goswamis were in separation, okay, they were experiencing separation, but they were also active. Like, you know, you hear about the six Goswamis. They were, their moods, you know, like in that, what is it? Srinivas Acharya in that song, Sri Sat Goswami Astaka, he says, Radha Kunda Tate Kalindi Tanaya Tire Chivamsi Vite Premon Madhavashada Shesha Dasaya Grasto Pramato Sada Gayanto Chakada Hare Gunavaram Bhavabi Bhuto Murha Bande Rupa Sanatana Vigri Go Shijiva Gopalago and Hey Rad Hey Rajadevi K Chalalite Hey Nanda Suno Kuta Shri Govardhana Kalpa Paratale Kalindi Vane Kutash Gosantaviti Sarvato Vajapare Kadara Mahavivalo Bande Rupa Sanatana Vigri Go Shijiva Gopalago. So the six Goswamis, they were sometimes on the banks of the Jamuna, sometimes at Bumsi Bhat, you know, and they appear just like madmen in the full ecstasy of love for Krishna, exhibiting different transcendental symptoms in their body. But they always merge in the ecstasy of Krishna consciousness. And it goes on to say that sometimes they were shouting, Queen of Vrindavan, Radharani, O Lalita, O son of Nanda Maharaj, where are you? Are you just on the hill of Govindan? Are you under the trees of the banks of the Jamuna? Where are you? And it says, these were their moods in executing Krishna consciousness, you see? But their activities were mentioned in the previous verse, Shankya Purvakana Magana Natibi Kalavasani Krito. You know, their activities was they were bowing down in scheduled measurements. You know, they were chanting Sankhya Purvakanamagana. They're keeping numerical strength. They were chanting according to numerical strength, and they were bowing down to scheduled measurements. So, you know, they weren't just moping around. They were engaging in devotional activities and preaching Krishna consciousness, but internally they were experiencing that separation. But when we hear about these devotees, in the Vrindavan Leela, it's just all we hear about is how the cowherd boys are just trying to forget the songs and lying down on the field, and Mother Yasoda is just standing there like a stick, you know, just when she sees Krishna's stick, just stunned, and Radharani's crying so much, and, you know, she's gone. How is that service, somebody might say? Why don't they just, you know, pick up a D-lamp and perform an artik or something like that, you know? Well, and this is over my head, way over my head, but I just thought of one example came to my mind that help me get some handle on it, understanding that. I could just throw it up and maybe somebody could enlighten us further. But about a month ago or so, I was out on traveling Sankirtan with the fellows, you know, and it was the morning. We just were finishing up a morning program, and my cell phone rang. So I flipped it open, and I saw, that's not a number I recognize. I said, okay, I'll take the call. I took the call. Worked out like I was getting a call from one of my friends that I grew up with. You know, I'm from New York City, and I grew up, and my situation was we had I lived in a housing project, and kind of like on the outskirts was a park with a basketball court. And it was like the place where all of us used to go and play punch ball, basketball, football, you name it. And we played it, you know. And we did it with the same group of kids from the time we were about 5 to the time I was about 16, 17 years old. So, you know, we became good friends, obviously. And so I got a phone call. And I hadn't been in contact with any of these friends for since about like 1968. So what's that? 43 years, I guess. Yeah, so for a long time. And I got the call. And it was one of my friends, Neil Altabet, you know. And I said, wow, far out, you know. And he was just calling because somehow he got my information, and he gave me a ring just to say, hey, howdy, bowl. Not, well, he didn't say howdy, bowl. Just to say hello, and how are you, and this and that, you know, and how you been, what are you up to? And I said, oh, that's really good. And I also got a call from another friend. I told him, yeah, because some of these friends are in touch with each other. And so I said, yeah, if anybody else wants to, you're welcome to give the number out, you know. So then a short time after, I got a call from another friend. And the point being that, so I felt really like, wow, you know, this is 40-something years later, and you know, my friends are remembering me, and they were calling me up to invite me to a reunion they're having sometime in April, you know, those of us who are still alive, which is most of us, you know, to meet back at that and just talk about old times, I guess, and like that. But the thing was, I felt touched. You know, I thought, wow, they remembered me. Wow, that's amazing. After 43 years. So the point is like, well, Krishna is a person. I mean, Krishna is a supreme person. So these devotees, you know, they're doing service for Krishna just by feeling these things. You know, it's like I felt like appreciation for their feeling. Just that they bothered to ring me, and just that they were feeling, just knowing that they're feeling, they remember me. And I felt like, wow, these are my friends, you know. And I felt like some love and everything, you know, in a mundane way, some sentiment. So Krishna is the supreme person, and when these you know, greatly liberated souls like the cowherd boys and the devotees and these rasas, you know, their feelings are so, like, intense and so, like, deep and so amazing, you know, that and Krishna's aware of that. So just them feeling like that, that they're actually feeling that love for Krishna, even in Krishna's absence, that's a service. They're serving Krishna by just having those feelings, just by feeling those feelings. And anyway, that was best I could come up with. This is my own little project. I'm trying to better understand this. These rasas, just Prabhupada says about the Nectar of Devotion. When this book came out, Prabhupada was giving class, and he said, okay, this great book, Nectar of Devotion, has come out. He said, everybody, please get a copy. And he said, and read it. He said, read it once, twice, three times. And then he went on to say, unless you have got full-fledged ideas, what is this devotional service? Keep reading it. So that's what, you know, Prabhupada wanted us to do. And the idea is that, you know, it's not just information. It's like the Hare Krishna mantra, you know. It's pure love for Krishna is there within the heart of every living entity. It just has to be awakened by the process of hearing and chanting. So just like with the Hare Krishna mantra, you know, we're not chanting Hare Krishna to get information. What information do you get? It's saying the same thing over and over again. It's purifying the consciousness. So in the same way, even if you don't understand what's in the Nectar Devotion or any of Prabhupada's books, it's pure transcendental sound vibration just by repeated, reading, by absorbing the consciousness in these transcendental sound vibrations, it becomes purified, and that understanding will awaken from within the heart. It's not a question of, you know, getting knowledge by a mundane process. It's just a question of, by purification of consciousness, this knowledge, which is already within us, because pure love of Krishna is lying dormant within the heart of every living entity, will be awakened. Okay, I'll stop there. Sorry, I went a bit over time, but I'll stop there. Thank you. Anybody have any questions or comments? Oh, thank you. Archita Prabhu. Yeah. Yeah.
About seniority. So then the obvious question would be that Lord Brahma is the most senior. Narada Muni, Angirada, his offspring, And Narada Muni even approached him at one point in the Bhagavad Gita and asked him, you know, please give me transcendent knowledge that you appear to be the Supreme, like that. So why not just take everybody, if you're going to follow that logic, why stop at Narada? Why not just take everybody to Lord Brahma?
Well, the only thing I could think of is, at least I'm not aware that that's part of Lord Brahma's portfolio. You know, I mean, like Narada Muni is kind of like well known as traveling and preaching. He's going all over the place. He's preaching to this person here and that person there. And so that's kind of, it's his service. You know, whereas Lord Brahma, he's just up there at the ocean of milk. And no, I don't know. That's the best I can come up with. It's not his part of his program, basic program. Otherwise, perhaps, you know, it would have been appropriate to ask him. Somebody can give a better answer than that, please go for it. I think Amal Bhakti had his hand up first. Do you have a better? Why not Lord Brahma? Why didn't he approach Lord Brahma, his father, actually? Give us the point. I don't honestly know.
Now the point is not to go higher and higher. The question is what does Narada Muni, what does he mean? What is he? He's an incarnation of bhakti. This is the most important thing. And that's what was going to be conveyed to King Chitraketu, the pure bhakti. And that's actually what develops, because Narada Muni has that potency, he has that sweetness, he has that love. And so in the course of the awakening, where he awakens this child, and this child begins to speak the highest, basically, bhakti philosophy, or let us say the basics or the beginning, you know. Who are you? What makes you think you're my only father? I have had so many fathers and mothers and so forth. Mm. And that the ultimate goal of life is to develop love for the ultimate father or the highest father, which is pure love of God or love of Krishna. So Narada Muni is, as I said, he is an incarnation of bhakti, and he could give his heartfelt understanding and ideally to convey that to King Chitraketu, who, as we know, did become, even in 7 days, he became an enlightened soul.
Thank you.
But then we're dissing Lord Brahma if we take this approach. He's the head of the whole Bhakti Sampradaya. Are we saying that he's not capable of competence to give somebody Bhakti? Very good.
You're okay. All right, somebody can help us out.
Yeah, he's certainly...
Sorry. You want to... Yeah, let's listen.
Our Bhagavatam is another example too, that many sages were in the, you know, when King Pariksit was going to leave his body and he wanted to know what to do, if you're going to do in 7 days, mm-hmm. if you have just 7 days. And many sages were there present too. And Sukadeva Goswami came, as we know, and he didn't have to be like older in age, but he was very knowledgeable. So if a person is very knowledgeable and is expert in the field, that person is the one who is qualified to speak. And if the other ones are very humble and very, Vaishnava etiquette, they will allow him to speak because they feel that this person knows what he's speaking about. So in the case of Narada Muni, I see that he, just like the example of if you want to know about cooking, you're not going to go to look for somebody else who is doing construction.
I understand what you're saying. It's a good point, but still, it's not, in this particular instance, it's not good enough because, Narada Muni approached Lord Brahma for instruction in devotional service. And as Archita said, Brahma Samhita, you know. Mm-hmm.
Narada Muni should speak. So Narada Muni spoke. In another situation, he may want somebody else. It's not just some mundane formula. Because again, when you're talking about Pariksit and Sukadev, there were other qualified, including Vyasadev himself. You're trying to say that he couldn't deliver Pariksit? That he doesn't have knowledge? Are you kidding me? No. It comes down to what Krishna wants.
How do you understand
Every single situation, what does Krishna want?
How do the devotees understand that, though?
That's what makes them devotees. Prabhupada makes a point in a purport in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna's in control of everyone's senses. But when you're not a devotee, he controls according to your degree of surrender. For the pure devotee, Krishna controls their senses directly. And that's what makes it so difficult and important not to offend pure devotees. Because you may think, he's a pure devotee, but he made this mistake. He didn't remember this, or he said that weird, or something happened that he should have seen. And Krishna's controlling their senses directly. That's the point Prabhupada is making. That's why it's so important not to misjudge pure devotees. If you accept that somebody's pure, like Srila Prabhupada, we all accept, then you cannot criticize. Everything that he did was perfect because Krishna was directly controlling his senses. So it's the same thing with these high-level sages. Krishna's directly controlling them. So he's telling Angria, this time you don't speak, let Narada speak. He's telling somebody else in some other situation, you do this, you do that, directly. That's the point of being a pure devotee.
Can I? It looks like... Okay.
The purport by Prabhupada, he was pretty much touching on the way that we have to deal with our god brothers, that we shouldn't, that we at least consider our god brothers to be like on the level of our spiritual master. If you go back to the text, so.
Well, that was something I read. That wasn't actually in the purport, but that was. Yeah.
Like in that particular text.
Okay.
That you've read. I guess it's one of those things that you have to do. Like, does it have to be the spiritual method? If you deal with our blood brothers at the level of the spiritual method, then it's more appreciated.
Okay. Anybody want to say one last thing, or we'll leave it at that? Okay, I'll attempt an answer. It's probably not going to be the best answer. But, the qualifications of a spiritual master are given in the 11th canto, Shrotriyam Brahmanishtam. So the spiritual master is Shrotriyam, that he's heard properly from his spiritual master, and he's able to repeat everything properly, you know, without changing anything. And also Brahmanishtam, which means he's nishtam, he's situated in Brahman. In other words, he's like obviously behaving on the transcendental platform. So for me, if I'm going to accept, you know, a devotee as not as infallible, I'm going to make sure that he's like somebody like that, like, you know, like a Dravida or somebody like that. You know, somebody who I could see is like really engaging in devotional service exactly according to the books and presenting devotional service exactly according to the philosophy. And then I would take that person as, okay, maybe this person's senses are being directly controlled by Krishna. But if it's just some new bhakta or something like that, or somebody who I could see, well, you know, that person doesn't seem to be on that kind of an elevated platform of devotional service, then I'd be respectful, but I wouldn't take it full on seriously that everything that that person is doing is being directly controlled by Krishna. That would be my way of dealing with it. And somebody else have, Archita, you want to?
Yeah, because this comes up. It's not that when a devotee sees Krishna's hand, that means that the person whose hand he's looking at is perfect. It's just like the case of the Muslims, Jagannath Puri temple. Lord Chaitanya was there. They didn't want to let Haridas Thakur in. So he's God. He could have changed that. But he didn't. So the devotee doesn't fight against things like that. We don't fight against things like that. If we know Krishna's in control of everything, and sometimes you may not like a particular conclusion. Prabhupada also, he directly told them that they were nonsense, but he didn't say go fight against it. So certain things, even if it doesn't, you know, sit well with you in terms of your understanding of what should happen, still you just go along with it. This is it. And if Krishna wants to change such situations, he will. But the point I was making earlier was that we're dealing with pure devotees here, pure souls, Angira and Narada. So it's not a question just of hierarchy or this or that. you have to always see that this is what Krishna wants. When pure devotees are involved in any situation, whatever they do is exactly what Krishna wants. So the reason why Narada is speaking is because that's what Krishna wants. He can't just find some mundane formula about, you know, who's more senior to whom and this and that. It's not always like that. And the case is what you brought up with Shukadev. He wasn't most senior, not necessarily most knowledgeable either. It's because he spoke Bhagavatam. He heard Bhagavatam. He heard the Bhagavatam from Vyasadeva. So Vyasadeva knew the Bhagavatam. Vyasadeva is the author of the Bhagavatam. So why didn't he speak? Because Krishna wanted Shukadev to speak in that situation. That was my point. Wherever these pure souls gather, whatever they do is being directly controlled by Krishna, just like a director of a play. So he's telling Shukadev, you say that. He's telling Prakshit, you say that. He's directly controlling their senses. So it comes down always to Krishna's desire, not some mundane formula of political viewpoint or this or that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Gantra Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.